From the Roots Up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Here we are. It's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. Good news. Next week, we're going to be raising funds for the great station CIUT, so get ready. Oh, well, you could start now, actually. You go to CIUT.fm, donate. You're in business. Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Good afternoon, Phil, and happy May Day.
Happy New Year. Did you say New Year?
I said Happy May Day, but it's like a New Year.
I'm going to go out and come in again. All right. Okay. All right. You're right. Thank you very much. We're going to talk about May Day. That's topic number one. Later in the show, by the way, we have a really important political matter all Canadians need to grapple with, and that is the ongoing hysteria, growing hysteria in the country over the issue of alleged Chinese, they always say foreign influence, they mean Chinese, and it's causing a lot of havoc, a lot of damage has been done, and it's frankly, in our opinion, it's a political disgrace that this is happening. So we're going to be talking to someone who really is on top of this matter and knows whereof he speaks, and Senator Yuen Pao Wu, who sits as an independent member of the Canadian Senate from British Columbia, and he has initiated a petition, he and others, which is advising and arguing that notions about a Foreign Agents Registration Act, FARA, is a really bad idea. And as we've been saying on the show, will divide Canadians, really lock us into old-style McCarthyism. You remember McCarthyism, Phil? Or you heard about it?
No, I remember it, Phil.
Okay, he confesses.
I might look young, but I remember Senator
McCarthy.
Yeah,
you fooled me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a nasty business, and there is a site, and I'm going to tell you right now, it's called yourviewsmatter.ca. If you want to read this petition and sign it, which I would urge you to do, you can go to that site, yourviewsmatter.ca. And you could also go to Senator Yuen Pao Wu, .ca, and there you will see at his site, he has, of course, been treating this subject actually at some length because there's been many aspects to it, the whole issue of Canada's posture in the world, but also domestic politics and how they're influenced by others. And by the way, on the subject of foreign influence, I mean, one of the things we will be asking him about, but we are reading in papers like The Globe and also The Star that we need to be more like Australia and the United States. And particularly in The Globe, I read almost every third day, one of their op-ed boys or girls says, we're really frustrating the Americans, you know, and our allies, you know, Australia. I notice they don't go beyond that. That's pretty much it. We have to be more like them. And I really doubt that people have come to this country in great numbers from around the world, that they came here because they wanted to be like Australians. That probably wasn't the top of their hopes. But anyway, we will get into that. It's Senator Yuen Pao Wu, and that'll be at 5:30. And this is the Taylor Report. And by the way, Phil, we have an announcement there. I think you have a copy of it. There's an event coming up.
The general public is invited to the reception for the launch of a new zine entitled Canada, Stop Arming Saudi Arabia in Hamilton, live Saturday, May the 13th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center. The zine is about Am I supposed to say Zine or Zine? Anyway, we'll say, I'll say Zine. The Zine is about grassroots support for the people of Yemen, which involved local people blocking Canadian arms shipments to Saudi Arabia. Admission is free, refreshments will be served, and you pick up a free copy of the Zine.
Okay, one more time, the place?
The Workers' Arts and Heritage Center.
And it is what time? When?
6 to 8 p.m., Saturday, May the 13th. And I'll look up the address for the Workers' Arts and Heritage Center because the announcement doesn't give it.
Double check.
Yeah.
Put Google on it. All right. This is the Tater Report, CIUT. And today, as Phil mentioned, is May Day. And I've noticed something. Five Eyes doesn't like May Day. All over the world, we have a partner called Amigo Number 3. And Amigo Number 3, that's Mexico, where we are doing a lot of business, and we particularly have a trade pact unfolding, and which should, you know, in order to have a trade pact, you try to get along with each other, not crowd. Mexico, May Day is a national holiday in Mexico. Actually, if you look at this hemisphere, every place practically in South America, including a lot of ones that you're probably not very fond of, they have May Day because they recognize it. It was something was established, and it has worldwide interest and sympathy. And, for example, Brazil, Venezuela, Honduras, Colombia, Chile, Peru, they recognize international. It's a holiday. Same is true in most of Europe. Places where they have problems with the issue is seems to be where it all began, in a way, which is the United States. There have been efforts to make May Day, to obliterate it, actually, and Canada goes along with it. We have something called Labor Day, which is set in September. In order to combat May Day as a holiday, the U.S. introduced ideas such as calling May 1st Loyalty Day. The American Bar Association in 1958 argued it should be National Law Day. It seemed like they had, what is it called, a bee in their bonnet about May Day. But let's go to the do some history. It's very important to know that, ironically, you might say, Chicago, the United States, is where May Day basically got on the map as a result of a combination of really important events affecting the working class of the United States. And of course, it was mirrored the experience of workers around the world. In the U.S., they were working 10 hours a day. It was very difficult, if not impossible. When I say 10, it could be 11, and it could be 6 days a week. And so the conditions are very rough. And in the 1880s, 1886 is the year that this thing exploded, literally. But leading up to it, in the 1880s, there had been organizing efforts, and not surprisingly, led by people called socialists, people called communists, and people called anarchists, all of whom knew each other, sometimes liked each other, sometimes did not. And these movements were growing, and they were providing a really important service in many, of course, the most important, bringing the concept of an educated working class that looks after its own interest being number one, but then also slogans around which people could rally. And the one that took off was the eight-hour day. And the idea, the concept was very clearly stated, 8 hours for 10 hours, eight for 10. You're working 10 now. You shouldn't have to work 10, and you should, because to have a life, you should have a 8-hour day, but you should receive the wages, which, by the way, are meager, but you should get that. And so that was really a popular idea. And in and city of Chicago, but also Cincinnati, New York, Milwaukee, and there was organizing here too, same concept. And there was a feeling of solidarity, of course, and recognition and mutual support. And on May 1st, they set the date, and they did it at a meeting, a couple of three meetings in 1885, they decided, okay, come May 1st, 1886, we're gonna just do it. We're gonna have a general strike. People will take off work and say we're not going back until we get the 8-hour day. It as a something to ignite movement and unanimity, it was successful. They had very large demonstrations. Particularly, we're talking now stateside, in Cincinnati and St. Louis, but primarily Chicago. The one in Chicago was, the estimates are in the tens of thousands, turned out. And at the front of the demonstration on May 1st in Chicago was Lucy Parsons, wife of the man Albert Parsons, who was later... will come to him, hanged for being an anarchist, actually. And so they had a political success, and they were winning. It was clear there was momentum towards this. There were city officials, mayors across the country, actually saying, "Yes, the 8-hour day is not a bad idea. You know, we're for that." By the way, to give everybody his credit, President Grant in 1868 had declared an 8-hour day for federal workers. And in Illinois and other states, they made workers sign a waiver that they would, despite that law, they would work anyway 10 hours. But the law said you're supposed to work 8. Curious country. I can't explain that. But at any rate, there was support. And so... on May the 3rd in Chicago, there was an uproar at the plant called McCormick's Reaper. What a lovely name, McCormick's Reaper. There, the workers had been on strike since February, and you had this magic ingredient that will cause, it's like nitroglycerin, it's called scabs. And McCormick was passionately anti-union, and he liked a good fight because he had, of course, the state on his side, and he also had private armies. He had Pinkertons. And so here you had a situation where the company had, step by stealth, had brought in workers to try to get the plant going again, and they were able to create smoke. Whenever the strikers look up and see smoke, they know they have a problem. And of course, McCormick would come and say to the workers, "Come back, you're free to come in. You know, these guys here are the union, but I don't recognize him. So I'm inviting you to come." And that always leads to violence, which is why in this country we've had political struggle to get anti-scab laws. Quebec has anti-scab laws. We actually had it here, and they got rid of it. Did you remember that, Phil? We actually had anti-scab legislation. But, you know, that offended the McCormicks of Canada. So at any rate, McCormick wanted a fight. He had his private guys with guns. And then there were the police. And on the day of the 3rd, nearby, at a lumber workers' gathering, a man named August Spees, editor, publisher of the workers' paper, Arbeiter Zeitung. You could probably pronounce it, Phil.
Arbeiter Zeitung, yes. And it was in German.
That's a little too close.
A good American newspaper.
Yes, it was a daily paper. And he was a very good orator, so he had been invited by the lumber workers to talk. But while he was speaking on the 3rd in the afternoon, the someone in the crowd, on the edge of the crowd, heard the bell ringing for the shift change over at McCormick's. So they rushed over, and there was a fight. And the police came and fired into the crowd and killed 6 or 7 people. But incidentally, if you're interested in historical facts, I cannot tell you for a fact, because the claims are made by all sides. And then as now, the reporting is not exactly conscientious. But there's no question the police fired into the crowd and that ordinary civilians were killed, unarmed people. So that happened on the 3rd. As a result, some of the socialist elements and union elements said, well, we should have a protest meeting for the killing of the, because it is, I mean, you massacre of workers. We have, this is as old as the struggle, is that when workers are killed, there is always calls for demonstrations and action of some one type or another. If you're not a good leader, then you don't know that you have to react. And so there was this reaction. And so the meeting was called for the evening of the 4th at Haymarket Square. And there's some interesting wrinkles in this, because one of the leaflets that called for the meeting put the word revenge at the top of the leaflet. This later in the court was a big deal. But actually, when the time came, the time came, they really only had one speaker there, and that was August Spies of Arbeiter Zeitung. Phil's the guy who can do that. I can't. I'm Phil, but I can't do it. And they realized they had a crowd. It wasn't a terribly big crowd. I mean, you can argue these things about, and they do that about how whether it was thousands and thousands. It was not that, but it wasn't a small crowd. But it was probably not what the organizers had hoped it would be. And so, Mr. Parsons, Albert Parsons, who was the editor of Alarm, a paper called Alarm. It was an English language weekly that was published out of the same building as the German paper Zeitung. Parsons really got around. He'd been down to Cincinnati and been speaking on the 3rd, and got back in the morning of the 4th. So he wasn't even in town when they planned the meeting. He wasn't involved at all. He and his wife, Lucy Parsons, told him that he was to help her that evening at a office where organizers came. There was a lot of organizing going on in Chicago. So she and her colleague, a woman I think named Horn, had been organizing sewing workers, women. And she told Albert that they needed him to come to the meeting. So they went to the meeting. This, we're talking about the great Haymarket thing. Parsons did not go to Haymarket. He went to a meeting with his wife and others who were interested in organizing what they described as sewing workers, women. And while they were at the meeting, word came, somebody said, look, find Parsons, because the crowd was mainly English speakers. Part of the phenomenon of May Day, or that particular moment, Haymarket, is that you had quite an interesting component of German-speaking people. And sometimes meetings would be all in German, sometimes they would be English, sometimes a little mixture. But this crowd, apparently, they identified and thought of as English speakers. So they came to where Parsons was, and they said, Spies can't go on much longer by himself. He's giving a talk, but he's going to need help. And so they asked Albert Parsons to go. So he and a man named Fielden, who was a teamster. He was from England. Fielden was from Lancashire. He later told the court that he first got introduced to union activity when they were boycotting and failing boycotting the cotton mill people in solidarity with the Abraham Lincoln and the war on slavery. So they weren't handling cotton, and he said we had, you know, it was life was tough. That was his earliest childhood memory, was that he was part of that. His family was, and they had suffered in solidarity with the struggle against slavery. So Fielden, he was there with Parsons. So the two of them went over to help Spies. So Spies is on the platform. It's not really a platform, it's a wagon. So they get up on the wagon, and Parsons spoke, and then Fielden spoke. And in the crowd, and this came out at the trial, in the crowd watching was the mayor of Chicago. And I don't know if you know this, Hill, but it wasn't as though it was a really exciting or... He was called, he was the first witness, we'll come to the bomb and how they happened to have a trial, but he was the first witness called by the defense because his evidence was that he was in the crowd, he had heard Fielden speak, he heard Parsons, he said he heard nothing remarkable, he didn't see any weapons, and the crowd was basically calm. And he had come just for that reason. He was afraid it would not be calm. As a matter of fact, he hoped his presence would keep it calm. That was his evidence at the trial. By the way, that should have closed the case in a way. But at any rate, so he then decided, the mayor, that things were okay. And so he left. And but on his way, as he left, about 20 minutes before the action started, they say, he passed the police, the closest police station. There was one quite nearby. And he said, there's no problem there. It's nothing's going to happen. Also, it was starting to rain, and people were drifting away from the meeting. So this is a very peculiar moment. When you think back, and you, if you ever hear the word Haymarket, think about what it actually was as opposed to the operatic qualities that have been added to it. I will say here, by the way, that I'm sorry that people, that artists have tried to render this moment, because in doing it, they have actually inflamed the situation. If you, there's a very famous painting or drawing done on the, within days, a famous sketch, and it's Fielden on the, standing on the wagon, and he has a beard, he looks like John Brown, and he's waving his fist, and then you see an explosion. And so you really have the idea that everybody's animated, everybody's excited, and, you know, and then the bomb is going off, and he's, you know, basically he looks like he's inciting people to do something criminal, probably, or bad, dangerous. So, but in reality, what happened? And the evidence is all consistent, including police witnesses. I've been reading the police witnesses' statements. There's a particularly nasty top cop, and I forget his name, but I'll call him Benson. Anyhow, he decided to bring forces. And so Fielden is giving a talk. Parsons has already gotten down off the wagon, everybody agrees, has left. Incidentally, Parsons had with him his two children and his wife and this the woman Horn. And if you're going to have be participating in a violent conflict with the police, you don't bring your two young, and these are small children, and his wife, you know, to such a gathering. But what had, so he had gotten off the wagon and gone up the street to a saloon nearby, which was frequented by all the union people in Chicago. So that's, he went there. He was in that building when the explosion happened. So Fielden was the last speaker. The police march up in like in a military formation, and they stop at the side of the right at the wagon under orders of Ben. I'm going to call him a Benson for the fun of it. Anyhow, and the top officer had said, "This meeting is over. Get down off that wagon." And Phelan, by all accounts, said, "We're not causing trouble, and we're happy to go. The meeting is over." And he was getting down off the wagon. So there's nobody left. There are no speakers on the wagon. At that moment, either someone began to fire, that is, and when I say someone among the police, it doesn't really matter. It's a matter of, this all happened at almost, I think we call a split second, a bomb goes off. It had been tossed from somewhere south and behind where the platform, where the wagon was, not from the wagon or any, but nearby, and it went, and the bomb went off amongst the officers, the police officers, killing one outright, and I think altogether seven police officers died, and of course from there all the rest happened. Here's the most important detail you need to know. Whoever threw the bomb was never identified. We don't know who to. So they never identified the bomber. And they arrested the organizers of the meeting or prominent individuals, many of whom weren't actually even there that night, that day. They arrested them, and they 1 month later, they arrest them in May. They have a trial in June, convict them in August, and then 1 year later in November 1887, they hang them. They hanged Parsons, they hanged Engel, they hanged Spies, and they hanged Fisher. And the Fisher and others said when they were had come to the last moments of their lives, they said, "We were accused of murder and hanged for anarchism." It was a clear case of political beliefs, or attributed beliefs, by the way, because the courtroom was very confused as to what they actually believed. And when they spoke for themselves, they each of them had, quite frankly, their own kind of point of view. Parsons gave a marvelous speech, when it came to November 80, and here's November 11, Phil, you know we do 11-11-11, okay, November 11th was the day they hanged the Haymarket anarchists for anarchism, not for murder, because, as I said, no one identified who the person was. And when you don't know, then how do you show a connection? Because we know that the accused did not throw it. They attempted one, what we call a police witness, tried to link it, but it didn't work. I mean, everybody just said, no, that's not credible, because all the evidence was the other way. Parsons didn't thrown anything, Fisher, Spies, Engel. But they were guilty of having ideas. And lo and behold, one of the people who came to see them was Eleanor Marks and her husband, Edward Aveling. And according to her own account, Eleanor was in Chicago for 4 days. She gave a talk every evening at mainly the German halls, but other halls, where they were standing room only to hear her talk. And she opened each talk by calling for mercy for the Haymarket martyrs, as they're now called properly. But it was out of that from that then, the labor movements around the world said, let's make Haymarket, and let's make that the eight-hour movement, and May Day as marking the moment for international solidarity. Let's do that, including Sam Gompers. Actually, I read a letter from Eleanor Marks to Sam Gompers. The opening line is, "Comrade Sam, Dear Comrades, which later she probably wouldn't have written that, but by the way, her writing on this matter is very sophisticated. I urge you to go and find it. I think we're almost at an... No, we got a moment or two, do we? Can you read sign language from... Anyway.
I think we're getting ready.
We're almost ready. We're going to take a musical break. They were fighting for the 8-hour day, so we have a song by Feeney, yes, that's her name, called Whatever Happened to the 8-Hour Day. And then we'll come back and talk to Senator Wu.